I was a football fanatic. I loved playing football. I would have kicked a Coke can around the street just to play football.
Growing up, they never had a lot as a family, but it was a happy home.
I come from a big family. There was 12 children. We had a fireplace in our bedroom, which was only lit once a year, and that was Christmas, and seeing the reflection of the flames flicker at the wall. But then what seemed like overnight, when I was about 8 or 9 years of age, everything suddenly changed, and Northern Ireland became a very violent place.
It was the late 60s, and a wave of violence swept through Northern Ireland as what was later to become known as the Troubles started. The area of Derry, known as the Creggan, was predominantly Catholic, and it was a hotspot of the Troubles. Richard was 10 years of age, and all this activity made quite an impression.
It was a real life game, it really was. Do you know, it was exciting. Then when you start to see the police or the army, it's awesome. You know, you're looking at it as a child going, you know, this is incredible.
The violence in Northern Ireland continued and intensified, with the British Army deploying thousands of troops to the region, and one of those troops was a 28-year-old man called Charles Innes.
The violence was at a level whereby, almost on a daily basis, a soldier, a policeman or prison officer was either very seriously injured or killed.
And you were stationed in this sort of lookout post, was it, overlooking the neighbourhood?
The police post itself was really more like a small fort. Every night we were shot at, and quite a number of occasions we had nail bombs chucked over the fence, and the adrenaline flowed pretty well.
And this lookout post Charles and the other soldiers were stationed in was situated close to Richard's school.
Bring us back to that day that this is all centred around. It was in May of 1972. What do you remember of that day itself?
That day was like any normal day. You're just full of energy. You've just got out of school. Brilliant, you know, school's over for the day. Me and my friends had a race up through the football pitch. And in doing that, we had to pass this British Army lookout post.
What had actually happened during that day, there'd been, as indeed was the norm, a considerable amount of stone throwing by youngsters at the lookout post.
This is where their two accounts of the day start to differ. Charles maintains that there was a large group of young people, from very young to teenagers and 20-year-olds, posing a danger to the soldiers inside the lookout post. Richard says it was a group of 10-year-old boys, running past on their way home from school, maybe throwing stones. He simply can't remember.
Basically, the equipment we had were simply small arms, and in any of these situations, that was without question never going to be used in this situation. The only other weapon of any means we had of dealing with this was a so-called rubber bullet gun. And in general terms, if you got hit by one in your body, it would sting and so on, but it really wasn't much more than that. So nobody thought much about using these rubber bullet guns.
So you're 10 years of age, you're running by this post, running home, and what do you remember?
You know, I just remember it being a nice sunny day. What I remember is running past.
I gave the warning. We got the usual reaction, more stones, more invective and screaming and so on and so forth at us. And so I just did what was a normal procedure. I fired this rubber bullet.
It's a true saying when people say you don't hear the bang, and I didn't hear any bang.
One of the ewes went down.
And then the next thing I remember is I woke up and I was lying on the school canteen table. My music teacher, he was with me. He had lifted me and carried me in and put me on the table. So I remember him talking to me. And I remember him saying to me, "What's your name, son?" And I told him my name was Richard Murr.
And could you see anything?
No, I couldn't see anything then. I don't remember anything then until I woke up in the ambulance.
A warning, when Richard describes the state he was in, it is distressing.
My eyeballs were out of their sockets and were down at my cheekbones and stuff. And my face was just a bloody mess. Like, I was hit from about 10 feet. My daddy kept saying to me, "You'll be okay, Richard, you'll be all right."
20 minutes later, half an hour later, my boss said basically he needed to come down, talk to me, as there's been a real major problem. And he said, "Charles, you better sit down." He said, "That rubber bullet you fired hit a boy 10 years old, and he may well die. He's so seriously injured." I was absolutely shocked. I was absolutely appalled. I just felt absolutely dreadful and thought, this is just simply horrific.
From your point of view, did you know you were shooting into a bunch of 10-year-old boys or...?
No, not at all.
And then finally they told my parents that I would be blind for the rest of my life.
And over time, the shock of it certainly went, but the sadness and the regret remained with me for a very long time.
And did you know much about his condition? Were you kept up to date afterwards? Did you know, for instance, that he was blinded and he probably wouldn't get his sight back?
No, I didn't get any information at all. In quiet moments, I used to think about the lad. I didn't know who he was or what he was, but I thought about him and I still had this so deep regret and great sadness that I'd caused this terrible injury to him.
I remember my mammy coming up and kneeling beside my bed just after I got to hospital, and she used to think I was sleeping, and she'd be kneeling down, she would start to say her prayers, and then she'd break down and start to cry, and then the crying would just get out of control. She'd be almost losing her breath, sobbing and stuff, and she'd be pleading with God, you know, "Please give him back his eyesight, please give him back his eyesight."
Following the incident, there was an official inquiry by both the British Army and the British Police Force into what happened, and Richard's family did receive compensation for his injuries. Richard went on to graduate from mainstream school with flying colours. Then in 2006, a TV company were making a documentary about Richard's life, and they helped him track down Charles. Through a third party, Richard was able to get a letter hand-delivered to him, asking him to meet.
I wanted him to know that I had no hatred towards him, and I wanted him to know that I forgive him. And I would like to think that if I hurt somebody, that they would find it within their heart to forgive me.
And it was an absolutely beautiful letter. There was simply no animosity. It was so positive. It was absolutely superb. And basically, he said, "I would very much like to meet you."
Richard flew to Edinburgh in Scotland, where Charles lives, and sat waiting for him in the lobby of a hotel.
I remember, suddenly I began to feel nerves in my stomach. I began to feel weepy.
I walked into the foyer. There he was sitting in the foyer of the hotel. I walked up, tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Hello, Richard, I'm Charles."
And what was he like when you met him? And then what did you talk about?
I had that wonderful experience of, and he did as well, of seeing, is this somebody I've almost known all my life? That sort of feeling. It just seemed he was somebody I just related to so well. We both told our stories. Let us see the way ahead.
You know, when you meet Richard, it's obvious that he is blind. He's missing one eye and a glass eye in the other. But when you met him, did you feel like saying, "Richard, I'm sorry"?
We never got to the stage of saying sorry, particularly. I never particularly did. The atmosphere of the situation was such, it was a point of discussion. And indeed, as people said, if you knew now what you know as to what had happened, would you have done it? And the answer is, of course I wouldn't. There's absolutely no question. Most certainly I wouldn't have fired that rubber bullet if I had known what it was going to do, the damage it was going to do.
Charles never said sorry, but I always felt he was sorry. I just felt he couldn't bring himself to say it. Sometimes things happen in life that we love to regret. I do forgive Charles.
How much do you value now your friendship with Richard and the time you spend together or talking on the phone or in correspondence?
I value it enormously to the degree whereby when I die, I have two friends who I would like to talk at my funeral, and one of them is Richard.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
What we have tried to do, and this is very important, of course, both of us, is the reconciliation of people from both sides of the divide.
At the end of the day, I am prepared to forgive and move on.